Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. The war in Ukraine has led to a closing of ranks in the West, with media and politicians in lockstep, united against Russia. And some self-described leftists have joined this righteous crusade. But as in many recent conflicts, the left has been riven by Byzantine sectarian divisions over what is the correct position to take, with Putinism replacing Assadism as the new term used to excommunicate opponents of war and American intervention. Despite the fact that the left in the West has no institutional or cultural power, and the anti-war movement is arguably at its weakest point, we are targeted, removed from the internet and social media, as the supporters of war seek to publicly shame us. Too often, the new generation of useful idiots capitalizing on their past as leftists seek to legitimize their betrayal and the new imperialist adventures by pointing to us and tarnishing our reputations with a scarlet letter of their own. To understand the history of the Western left and how it's reacted to recent crises, I'm joined by Ben Norton, an investigative journalist based in Latin America and editor of the independent news website Multipolarista. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rania. It's one of my favorite shows, so it's always a pleasure being here.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on. And before we get started, a quick reminder to those who are watching, you can listen to every episode of Dispatches anywhere you get podcasts. And to those who are listening, you can watch every episode at the Breakthrough News YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe. And of course, you can support our work here at Breakthrough News by becoming a patron at patreon.com/breakthrough news. Okay, so now that solicitation for independent media is out of the way, Ben.
We all have to do it.
But I just want to get right into it, because I think this is such an important topic, especially since we're in the time of yet another major war. So can you start out maybe by walking us through the most relevant tendencies on the Western left and where they stand with respect to the war in Ukraine? And then after that, we can get into like why these tendencies exist the way they do.
Well, first of all, I think that we need to be clear that these splits are not necessarily unique to the US left. We could talk about similar splits in the European left and in general, kind of internationally. But I think we also need to distinguish at the beginning of this conversation here, these tendencies within the left in the imperial core and the global north and in the global south, because these splits do kind of exist in the global south in some ways, but they tend to be very minor because the left in the global south in the periphery tends to be pretty unified on questions of anti-imperialism, right? Because they're in the global south, they're in the periphery. These splits tend to be much more common in the imperial core. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that being a socialist in the imperial core brings extra responsibilities with extra sensitivity to the fact that it's not the same as being a socialist in the global south, that you have different responsibilities, that you have a different political role. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, in the global north, don't necessarily think about that perspective. They don't understand that they do have to play a different role as socialists, because they have this historic responsibility and current responsibility to challenge imperialism, to challenge neocolonialism. And so the socialist struggle is not going to be the same everywhere. So in terms of the US, you know, there's a very long and sometimes inglorious history of socialist movements, parties, organizations ignoring that responsibility, abandoning anti-imperialism, and really allying in some ways with imperialism, but trying to basically do it in a left-wing way and say that, well, we can be socialists, but also basically support imperialism. That misunderstands that if you want to be anti-capitalist, you have to be anti-imperialist, because the whole understanding of capitalism for the past 100 years is that capitalism is a global system. It is not just based in your country, and that global system is undergirded by imperialism. Imperialism is the way in which capitalism is organized internationally. There's not just a division of labor locally in your country. That is, you don't just have companies exploiting people in Amazon and McDonald's and Walmart in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of exploitation of workers in the US, and we should absolutely support the workers in Amazon who are unionizing and in other companies. But we also need to understand that there's an international division of labor. Where do the materials, the raw materials used to create those goods come from? They come pretty much from the global south. They create the shirts, the pants, even much of the food products that are sold in those companies in the global north. So even within the working class in the United States, there are all these divisions. And then there are the international divisions. So long story short, the point I wanted to stress there at the beginning is that there needs to be extra sensitivity to that understanding. And that needs to be a key part of the socialist struggle in the global north, is understanding how to also challenge imperialism, because otherwise what you end up doing is just trying to divide the treasure of the imperial plunder, right? And just right. all the imperial pillaging of done of the global south, you can just divide that more equitably in the global north. That's not what we as socialists, as anti-imperialists, that's not what we want. We want to actually have workers' democracy, economic democracy for all workers around the world. And that isn't to say that the struggle of workers in the global north is not relevant. It's absolutely relevant. It's important. We need to have more unions, have better workers' protections. But it needs to always be done with the understanding that that struggle has to go hand in hand with the anti-imperialist struggle. So I say that just to understand that contradiction is exactly what has led historically to so many divisions within the left and the global north. I would argue that the vast majority of the splits in the left have historically been because of that contradiction of imperialism. And that brings us to the war in Ukraine today. And we see this same split in very similar ways, where you see some elements on the left in the US and Europe and Canada basically defending NATO. And these tend to be the softer kind of social democratic movements who basically say that NATO is a defensive alliance, which ignores the entire history of NATO and how it destroyed Libya, it destroyed Yugoslavia, it supported fascists and former Nazis in Operation Gladio during the first Cold War. NATO is not a defensive alliance. It has always been a right-wing, offensive, anti-communist alliance. It was formed in 1949, including the fascist dictatorship of Portugal as one of the founding members. So there's those factions of the left. Then there's also a faction basically saying that this is an inter-imperialist rivalry, that Russia is supposedly an imperialist power and that the US is an imperialist power. And we should say, you know, pox on both their houses. We're against both, neither Washington nor Moscow. And this is a position which we'll talk about that goes back to the first Cold War. And basically this kind of both sidesism ends up justifying imperialism and justifying the role of the US in provoking many of these wars. So that's another position I think that is pretty problematic. In fact, Rania, you're over at Breakthrough News, your colleague Brian Becker at the Socialist Program and I had a really good discussion about why Russia's not an imperialist power. The war in Ukraine is not an inter-imperialist war. In many ways, Russia, the existence of Russia as a nation state, the territorial integrity of Russia is pretty on weak footing. And we have seen that the US and NATO have been desperately trying to break up the Russian Federation as they did to Yugoslavia. And this isn't to justify the Russian invasion, which I think is extremely tragic and bad for the people of Ukraine, bad for the people of Russia for that matter. But the reality is that if you ignore that historical context of NATO and the US doing everything they can to surround Russia with military bases, violating their promises not to expand, putting weapons directly on Russia's borders, doing military exercises in Estonia right on Russia's borders, threatening to put nuclear weapons in Ukraine, a de facto NATOization of Ukraine through military interoperability of the Ukrainian military with NATO's military forces. If you ignore all of that history, and then just say that Russia is bad, but also the US is bad, and that's not a proper socialist analysis. So, and then right. Finally, the other major split you can see right now is those of us who I think, you know, I think is the correct position, is understanding that, yes, that doesn't mean that we endorse the war, but we also have to understand that it is the US and NATO that bear responsibility for starting this war. And I should say that this is the position of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. So, you know, we constantly hear of this talk of, well, what is the agency of leftists yeah. in the country, right? Well, there is a massive country in, excuse me, there's a massive party in Russia, which is socialist and anti-imperialist. It's called the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. By the way, it's the second largest party in all of Russia. It is the main opposition party in Russia. And their position has been saying, you can find this in English on their website, the US and NATO are responsible for starting this war. So those are the different splits and the different perspectives on this war. And we can talk about, you know, what brought the left and the US to be so divided on these questions.
But I want to bring it, like, I want to bring everything you just talked about to today. Because, and when I mean today, I mean like the last 20 years, let's say. Because the wars we've had over the last 20 years, especially for those who are, you know, part of our younger audience, they might be, they oftentimes think that there was some sort of like anti-war movement, which there was, that was, you know, united over the Iraq war. And I think that the thing is, though, the Iraq war was a bit of an exception because it was probably the first time since maybe the Vietnam War, which you mentioned also had its splits, but at some point it did become like a big, everybody was against it kind of movement. But with the Iraq war, it was like, it seemed like everyone on the left was against it for the most part. And I mean the second Iraq war, not the first one. But then I think it, for those who are maybe like under the age of 40, it got really confusing because you get to the Arab Spring to 2011. And then suddenly you saw this bizarre split over the issue of Libya and the no-fly zone and over the issue of Syria, which was even bigger, I think, and lasted even longer and did so much damage to the left, including to like the Palestine Solidarity Movement, which you and I have discussed on other platforms before, so we don't need to get too much into that. But I'm wondering if you could just very briefly connect what you just discussed to some of the splits that we see today coming into the war on the war in Ukraine as well, where you do see this split of like, these are the common talking points. You have to support Libyan agency. You have to support Syrian agency. You have to support Ukrainian agency. Just because the US is an empire and is imperialist doesn't mean that Russia's not imperialist and can't do just as bad to Ukraine. Doesn't mean that Assad isn't evil and you must support overthrowing him. It doesn't mean that Gaddafi isn't evil, right? We have to support the leftists on the ground. And then we also have to support not just the leftists on the ground, the reactionary forces on the ground, because they're at the forefront of a revolution. So can you kind of talk about how ever, like all of what you just discussed from 100 years ago, from 50 years ago, is actually totally relevant to what we see happening today over these wars?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason I went into all that history, explaining it in detail, is because these are really the same kind of political divisions that we see today. That's why I said going back 100 years to 1916 with the split in the Second International over World War I, we see again and again and again this pattern of the left being split over these questions of imperialism. And today, I mean, it's still extremely relevant. You mentioned something very important, Rania, Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was in many ways similar to how the Syria war kind of split the US left. I mean, Vietnam was so similar. Today, we have this idea that the left was all against the war in Vietnam. No, 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 no. Unfortunately, I don't say this with happiness. There were a lot of parts of the US left that were very soft on or even supportive of the war in Vietnam because they said that Ho Chi Minh was an evil Stalinist. Mm. And they said that it was evil authoritarian communism, Stalinism, and that the U.S. had to defeat the evil Stalinists and defend democracy. I mean, we see that these kind of same talking points recycled, just as we saw people basically saying that we have to ally with the CIA and Jabhat al-Nusra, Syrian al-Qaeda, because of evil Assadism and Assadists. No, I mean, this is an infantile analysis. Let's not forget that in the 1960s and 70s, there were splits in the U.S. left over the question of Vietnam. I mean, one of the most famous examples is the Beyond Vietnam speech by MLK, right? Martin Luther King Jr. was, I mean, he wasn't a mainstream figure. The mainstream acceptance of MLK came much later, but he wasn't as demonized until he gave this famous speech, Beyond Vietnam, in which he said that the U.S. is the world's leading purveyor, the leading purveyor of violence in the world. That's an exact quote. The U.S. is the leading purveyor of violence in the world. He came out against the war in Vietnam, and he said that the three evils were racism, consumerism, and militarism. Bringing in militarism specifically, he started becoming more strident.
What a tanky.
Sorry?
What a tanky.
No, exactly. So, and actually, there were a lot of splits over that. And in fact, there's a figure who's not as well known. Ironically, Obama is trying to make a movie about this guy, a CIA agent who was part of the left, who was trying to divide the left back then, named Bayard Rustin. And Bayard Rustin famously criticized MLK for going out against the Vietnam War. Bayard Rustin also was famous. He was a civil rights activist. He became a CIA agent. He was famous also, and a neoconservative, by the way. He was also famous for convincing MLK to abandon violence and opposing Malcolm X and encouraging nonviolence. Because at the beginning, I mean, MLK actually, you know, he had guns in his house for self-defense because there had been so many assassination attempts against him. And Bayard Rustin later became a leader of Social Democrats USA. Social Democrats USA was an organization that split after the Socialist Party of America. It actually ended up splitting over because they decided they were just going to support the Democratic Party. And they didn't want to run independent presidential candidates. And they split between the Social Democrats USA, and Bayard Rustin was one of the leaders. And then they also split into the Socialist Party USA, which continued running presidential candidates and opposing the Democratic Party. And then there was another split led by this guy named Michael Harrington, who formed DSA. And those splits all represented different divisions over the question of Vietnam. Social Democrats USA basically were soft supporters of Vietnam because they said that the Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese National Liberation Front were Stalinists and that they had to be opposed. Whereas Michael Harrington opposed the resistance, the guy who founded DSA, he did not support the Vietnamese resistance, but he also called for withdrawing the US military. And then there were the revolutionary socialists, the anti-imperialists, who supported the Vietnamese people's resistance against this genocidal war led by US imperialism. And that led to splits even within SDS, you know, this famous, you know, organization of students, right? And then also there's another famous split in SNCC, right? The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they changed their name to the Student National Coordinating Committee. They dropped their commitment to nonviolence and they supported the Vietnamese resistance against imperialism. So the point is that all of these splits that we talk about over Syria, the same thing happened in the 1970s, 60s and 70s over Vietnam. The idea that the entire U.S. left was against Vietnam is completely false. Many parts of the U.S. left had a very bad position on Vietnam. And so it's not that surprising to see that people like Carl Gershman, who is Carl Gershman, the founding longtime director of the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED. This is a CIA cutout created in 1983 by the Ronald Reagan administration and Bill Casey's CIA. Carl Gershman had his origins in that same student movement, right? Carl Gershman was a leader of Social Democrats USA, along with Bayard Rustin. So the reason I mentioned that is you talked about the neoconservatives. There were neoconservative forces that merged later on because they took this position basically saying that the divisions in the left are not imperialism against anti-imperialism. It's not the Vietnamese people resisting this genocidal war waged by US imperialism. Rather, it's authoritarianism in scare quotes or democracy. And this explains this idea about Syria and Libya. It's the same ideological split. Carl Gershman, someone who worked for the Ronald Reagan administration, who became a neoconservative, basically, although he was always a Democrat. He was the leader until last year, from 1983 until 2021. He was the leader of the CIA cutout, the NED, that has carried out regime changes around the world, color revolutions. He was a leader of Social Democrats USA.
That's incredible.
Who had origins in that movement, because basically we see this idea, which I think is so fallacious, that the divisions in the left are between democracy and authoritarianism. It is too simplified. It is infantile. It refuses to understand the role that imperialism plays in all these conflicts. And this gets us to understanding why the left continues to make these same mistakes over Syria and Libya. It doesn't matter what you think about Bashar al-Assad and the government of Syria. This is a war led by the imperialist powers to destroy a post-colonial nation. This is a neo-colonial war. And similarly with Russia, it doesn't matter what you care, what you think about the Russian government. NATO and the U.S., Biden said it very clearly, they want to overthrow the government of Russia to create a new puppet regime and eventually to break up the Russian Federation, as Brzezinski infamously called for in 1997 in an article in Foreign Affairs, in which he said that Russia should be broken up into a European Russia, a Mongolian Russia, and an East Asia, a Siberian Russia and an East Asian Russia. That is the game plan. That is the game plan of imperialism.
You know, who would love that too is like these neo-Nazis who literally see Russia, by the way, as like the Mongols. They don't even view Russians as Slavic. They're Mongol. They're like descendants of Mongols, and we have to like cleanse them. But on that note,
Who also sees Russians that way is the Atlantic magazine. What was the magazine that had that photo of the image of Putin as like a Mongolian warlord?
I think it was it The Economist or was it The Economist. I can't even remember anymore, but they're all the same. But just
that's
on the note,
liberal imperialist white supremacist version of the neo-Nazi talking point.
It's incredible. It really is. But on that note, I do just want to show, I mean, the level of pressure. There are these people who exist in mainstream media outlets who call themselves leftists. I just want to show some examples of what we've seen just over the war in Ukraine. So this right here is The Guardian, George Monbiot. Who says we must confront Russian propaganda, even when it comes from those respect. The grim truth is that for years, a small part of the anti-imperialist left has been recycling Vladimir Putin's falsehoods. Okay, that's one. I just want to take us through a couple. Here is another one, the New Statesman. This is Paul Mason, who calls himself a leftist, but tends to love NATO. He says the left must stand with Ukraine against Putin's aggression. Progressives should abandon the delusion that this crisis has been triggered by NATO's encirclement of Russia. And of course, it goes on to like lambast the anti-imperialist left. Then across the Atlantic, we have Roan Carey at The Intercept going even harder, saying, don't be a tanky, how the left should respond to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Those who don't stand in solidarity with the oppressed cannot call themselves leftists. And the reason, you know, I even show these headlines is because it's just a handful of what has felt like a bit of an onslaught. From people who call themselves, and we saw this, by the way, over Syria and Libya too, this attempt to police the anti-imperialist left or smear the anti-imperialist left from people who call themselves leftists, and really they're just like social chauvinists. I'm not really sure. I mean, that term comes to mind. I'm not really sure like how I would classify each of these individuals. Social show where they want leftism domestically, but then when it comes to it's a lot of what you were just talking about, where when it comes to international affairs, they believe in this like permanent revolution, but they also don't believe that the global South is capable of leading the fight for socialism, of doing socialism correctly. It's always too dictatorial or tyrannical or authoritarian and, you know, that sort of things. All the talking points that we come up with. And these people aren't new. And I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about, real quick, before I ask you this question, I also can't go without sharing this piece from George Monbiot as well. This is during Syria. Orwell was hailed as a hero for fighting in Spain. Today, he'd be guilty of terrorism. And the reason I even bring up this piece is in this article. Oh, I'm sorry. You can't even see it. Hang on. I didn't share it correctly. There we go. In this article that I now have up on screen. So George Orwell is hailed as a hero for fighting Spain. Today, he'd be guilty of terrorism. He actually, I want to quote him here. He talks, or maybe I won't quote him, I'll just paraphrase because it's not worth necessarily quoting him. But in this piece, this is during the sort of like peak of the war, the regime change war on Syria. And what had happened was he was talking about a British man who had gone to Syria to fight with al-Nusra, which was the al-Qaeda affiliate there, and had blown himself up in an explosion, swarming the prison in Aleppo to like to free like other prisoners that would come join Al-Qaeda as well. And he was upset that this guy was being called a terrorist by the British government. And he goes, and this is, I'll quote him saying, "But can anyone claim that liberating the inmates of Syrian government prisons is not a good thing? As no one else is now likely to," and then he goes on to say, As the raid on the prison would have probably been impossible without the suicide bomb, should we not be celebrating this act of extraordinary courage? So he's talking about a guy. I mean, it's remarkable. He's talking about a guy here who literally like had joined Al-Qaeda, had left Britain to join Al-Qaeda to basically to like attack Syrians, blown himself up at a suicide bomber and praised his act of heroism. And he's trying to tell other leftists to support this. So there's this tendency of claiming to be a leftist, somehow being a leftist, but also writing for mainstream publications like The Guardian and policing the left, rest of the left, for not supporting fascists in these like proxy wars. And then the last thing I wanted to share here before I get to why I'm raising all of this is I wanted to share just the headline of a piece that you wrote that actually someone reminded me of this recently because people keep finding this. And this is about George Orwell and how George Orwell was a reactionary snitch who made a blacklist of leftists for the British government. And Ben, you wrote this, it's posted at your website. I can link to it in the description of this video, because it's a really important piece, because it speaks of a tendency of people that call themselves leftists, are considered leftists, even historically so. I mean, George Orwell is so praised and quoted. Yet, can you tell us about who George Orwell really was and why that matters today?
Absolutely. Rania, you use the term that is the perfect term to have to frame the discussion today: social chauvinist. You know, the point that we keep making in this conversation right now is that these same splits that we're seeing now are the same splits that we've seen for 100 years on the left. And it was Lenin himself who used that term social chauvinist to refer to the elements of the left that supported World War I, that supported imperialism. And he famously wrote Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, explaining how imperialism is capitalism, that at this stage of monopoly capital in which the colonialists carved up all of the world, imperialism is capitalism. It's not just, they're not separate systems. The capitalist system globally is the imperialist world system. And we've seen that again and again and again. Leftists, especially in the global north, have refused to see that. And instead they think they have this parochial view where they see everything within their narrow national borders. And what they really want is just, you know, they want a little bit of redistribution of wealth. There we go.
They want
a little redistribution of wealth within their own borders. They want healthcare and education. These are all great things. Of course, we support these policies, but that's where their so-called socialism or leftism ends, is at their own borders, right? And then they continue supporting wars around the world. You showed Paul Mason. Paul Mason supported the war in Libya, the war in Syria. George Monbiot. I mean, there's a reason these guys are allowed to continue to write for the Guardian of Blairism, the Guardian which opposes every existing socialist government, which opposed and destroyed the Corbyn movement, which opposes the left anywhere and everywhere it actually has power. These guys, Paul Mason and George Monbiot, they play a systemic role, right? And they play the same systemic role as the court jester of the left, the imperial court jesters of the left, except at least jesters are funny. These guys have no sense of humor. So George Orwell played the same political role. It's not a coincidence, by the way. We have evidence, the Telegraph, the British newspaper known as the Torygraph, because it's so close to the Conservative Party, published an article admitting that the CIA supported George Orwell. The CIA promoted his books and paid for turning Animal Farm into an animated film for children. There's a reason that every single U.S. high school teaches George Orwell. He was on message with the empire. He was promoted by the CIA. This is not speculation. This is an objective historical fact. And furthermore, George Orwell voluntarily collaborated with the British government because he hated communists more than he hated imperialists. And he had this idea, once again, this idea of so-called democracy versus authoritarianism, which, by the way, is ridiculous, because if you believe that the U.S. is a democracy, the country with 25% of the global's the world's prisoners, there are more people in U.S. prisons than at the peak of the Gulag system in the Soviet Union. But no one calls the U.S. prison system the Gulag. I mean,
because they're poor, because we prison people for being poor rather than just like. Like that's what they'll have that to cover is like oh, like it's they committed crimes of poverty or no crime at all and they're just poor. That's literally who lock up the vast majority of people.
Yeah, and meanwhile, George Orwell, by the way, was a British colonial officer. Let's never forget that, because it explains a huge part of his philosophy. He served in Myanmar as a British colonial officer, and that explains a lot of his very colonialist parochial racist worldview. And we know because we have something called Orwell's List, which is a document that he compiled for the British government. The British government during the First Cold War had a list of communists and communist sympathizers that there was its blacklist. And George Orwell helped to compile that list for the British government. And on that list, not only did he, by the way, put people for their ideology, he listed who was Jewish because he was an anti-Semite. He also listed some people saying that for instance, there were black anti-racist activists and revolutionaries on there, and he said that they were quite anti-white. He called the black activists anti-white. He also listed who was gay. I mean, a lot of people on that time had very reactionary views about LGBT people, but I mean, the point is that Orwell.
Yeah, but were they putting them on lists? Like, there's a different. Them on lists is a bit different. No,
I
mean, than
I was
just
saying
like,
in terms of the like.
Yeah.
In some ways, that's not unique, but like the racism and the homophobia. But he voluntarily collaborated with the British government. Why? Because George Orwell made a political decision, like many people in the Western imperial left, that basically they decided that they think that imperialist bourgeois so-called democracy is preferable to people in the global South trying to build socialism under impossible conditions of warfare and siege and blockades and sanctions. And it reflects this chauvinist mentality that is still very prevalent among the global North left that thinks that basically, despite all of the problems, the Western imperialist nations are still democracies, and all of those so-called backward people in Cuba and Vietnam and China and Korea and Nicaragua, they're all just barbaric authoritarians. Basically, this is the leftist version of Oriental despotism.
Yeah.
For hundreds of years, we were told that the reason in Asia that there were these monarchies, ignoring all of the hundreds of years of brutal European monarchies. And by the way, Britain is still a monarchy. Most of Europe is still a monarchy, by the way. But we were told that it was because of so-called Oriental despotism. And that ideology is so deep in even parts of the left. They still refuse, they deeply believe that the U.S. is a so-called democracy while it locks up black and brown people and has concentration camps for immigrants on the southern border. And after committing genocide against its native peoples, after enslaving black people, after having concentration camps for Japanese Americans within the lifetimes of our grandparents.
Yeah.
But the U.S. and Britain are still democracies, but Cuba is this horrible totalitarian hellscape. Because again, they might call themselves a socialist, but that doesn't mean anything. What they actually are imperialist social democrats. And going back to this term I started with, they are social chauvinists, just like the social democrats in 1916 who supported World War I.
It's also worth noting that they materially benefit from imperialism and live lifestyles of a certain kind of luxury that, if we're being honest here, wouldn't exist in the global North if it wasn't for stripping away resources. I mean, that's what imperialism is all about. It's about like having the vast majority of humanity in the global South live in poverty and destitution and literally living like parasites off of them in the global North. Like the reason there's infrastructure and wealth in the global North and people live the way they do is because there's like billions of people living the opposite lifestyle who are thirsty and hungry and don't have shelter. That goes back to the issue of people in the global North thinking that socialism means Denmark. It's like, no, we can't all be Denmark actually. And none of you even have actually the resources in your own land that you've mostly colonized, if we're talking about North America and Australia, you don't even have the resources in your own land to like be living the way you do. You literally are stealing it from an entire like hemisphere. But anyways,
briefly, Rania, on the subject of Scandinavian social democracy, let's not forget that they also play a key role in the imperialist world system, not only in terms of massive arms sales, which is never discussed, by the way, but huge arms manufacturers in the Scandinavian social democracies. Also, their role in colonialism, Danish colonialism, which is almost never talked about.
They get no credit.
Their role in NATO. I mean, let's not forget the role of Norway and other Scandinavian social democracies in destroying Libya, in the most prosperous country in Africa. You can't say anything good about the Libyan government's policies, which guaranteed free healthcare, education, even houses. When you were married in Libya, the government would help pay for you to have a house and a car. You can't defend those policies in Libya, because then you're an evil authoritarian, because it's brown Muslims doing it. But when Scandinavians carry out the same policies, well, that social democracy is okay because it's pro-imperialist, and because the only reason that the Scandinavian social democracy is allowed to continue to exist is because it's integrated within imperialism. We saw what happened when Sweden had an anti-imperialist leader. He was assassinated. His name was Olof Palme. Look up his history. He was assassinated. That was a message to all Swedish socialists. If you get off message, if you support the Nicaraguan Sandinista revolution, if you support these revolutionaries in the global South, as Olof Palme did, you'll get a bullet in the back of your head.
So that's very important to note. But I don't want to be so unfair to the left. I mean, obviously, you and I are products of the Western left, even though we don't like necessarily live in the U.S. anymore. But I don't want to be entirely unfair here. And, you know, we have to be honest about the fact that there was this concerted effort to disrupt and destroy the left in the global North, in particular, because it's very dangerous to have leftist anti-imperialist movements that are strong. Like you just said, I mean, assassinating a Swedish leader for being anti-imperialist, there's a danger to that. So can you kind of talk a little bit about the intentional state killing of the left in the global North, what that entailed, whether it's COINTELPRO using fascists and even infiltrating academia?
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you put it that way, Rania, because we should be clear that, you know, we do criticize the so-called Western left a lot, but there's also a lot of very brave people who have literally put their lives on the line in the Western left, and especially in the history of the U.S. left, the Black community. I mean, the brutal extermination of Black communists and socialists and activists and Black nationalists in the U.S. I mean, we are talking about a genocidal campaign waged by the U.S. government, not going back just to, of course, obviously the 18th and 19th centuries of enslavement and murder and Jim Crow, but, you know, even as recently as the era of COINTELPRO, right? And still today, I mean, let's not forget these very strange stories of these Black Lives Matter activists in Ferguson whose cars were like set on fire in these mysterious killings that are very suspicious. Very, very suspicious.
Or they like somehow end up like committing suicide with their hands behind, like handcuffed behind their back, like weird, really bizarre stories.
Like Gary Webb, who committed suicide with two bullets to the back of his head after exposing the CIA using drug money to fund the Contras in Central America. And by the way, dumping that cocaine in poor Black communities in LA.
But anyway, that actually happened, guys. Even the mainstream media admits it now. It's not a conspiracy theory anymore. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the most well-known example, because of this movie that was recently made, Judas and the Black Messiah, the most famous example is Fred Hampton. I mean, this was a Black communist who was straight up executed by the U.S. government, straight up assassination. We also have examples. I mean, a police officer from the NYPD recently wrote this letter on his deathbed admitting the NYPD's involvement in assassinating Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was not a communist. He was a Black nationalist, but he was a hardcore anti-imperialist. And we should never forget that. Malcolm X was a strong supporter of the Global South liberation movements, the Algerian struggles across the African continent against colonialism. And he created the Organization of Afro-Asian unity and was trying to bring together Black Americans with revolutionary movements in Africa and Asia and Latin America. He visited many parts of Africa and other parts of Latin America. And of course, Fred Hampton did as well. And the Black Panther, well, not Fred Hampton himself, but Huey Newton and other leaders of the Black Panther Party. They went to Gaza. They were somewhere in Nicaragua. So the point is that especially in the Black revolutionary movement in the United States, there's a long history of Black internationalists, anti-imperialists, socialists, nationalists being executed straight up by the government. I mean, there's a lot of questions about the U.S. government's role in the assassination of MLK as well, which I don't know if we'll ever get the answers to. So we should be clear about that. But then there's also the role of COINTELPRO. That's, I mentioned, the counterintelligence program by the FBI, which was aimed at spying on the U.S. left and anti-war movements. But furthermore, we should keep in mind that when people talk about COINTELPRO, they don't talk about the other elements of U.S. government warfare on the left in the U.S. And there's other elements that actually have been even more influential but are less known. And I'm talking about the campaign that the U.S. government waged to create a pro-imperialist, anti-communist left. And in order to understand this, we have to understand what is the Congress for Cultural Freedom. This was an organization created by the CIA to fund left-wing organizations in the US and in Europe that were anti-communist. And we've seen big names like Gloria Steinem, one of the mothers of, you know, liberal bourgeois feminism in the U.S.
I feel like you have to have a woman on screen when you say this. I'm sorry. Just to make it okay. No, it's actually shocking. Continue. It's pretty.
Gloria Steinem worked for the CIA, and there's a video on YouTube of her admitting it and saying that you don't understand, the CIA are very progressive. And this brings us back to this last year, 2021, the CIA released this ad, which people joke is like the woke intersectional imperialist ad, of a Latina woman talking about how she's an intersectional feminist and how she is not going to allow men to talk over her and how she's a CIA agent and doing like spoken word poetry. And that, I mean, that's not new. I actually did a long video explaining the history of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and how the CIA, for much of its history, the CIA was created after World War II, and it had its origins in the OSS, the Office of Strategic, that oversaw the intelligence in World War II against Nazi Germany. And the OSS actually brought on a lot of anti-Soviet Marxists from what was called the Frankfurt School, like Adorno and Horkheimer and Marcuse. These figures who are very popular in academia. Outside of academia, no one knows who they are because they're irrelevant to actual working class struggle. You know, activists on the street don't know who they are because they were just academics who talked about culture. But the OSS and then later the CIA brought on a lot of these Eastern European and German anti-Soviet academic Marxists and then tried to create this entire movement of anti-Soviet, anti-communist Marxism, and it led to these kinds of soft left, liberal left movements that were funded in many cases by the CIA. And the CIA also funded magazines. There were something, for instance, The Partisan Review and others. These were magazines that were funded. They were leftist magazines that were funded by the CIA, and they would publish leftist writers, and they would also publish people like George Orwell. And there are two very good books explaining this history. One is called The Cultural Cold War, and the other is called Thinks. And both of these books show how many prominent figures on the left, I mentioned Bayard Rustin, a CIA agent. I mentioned Gloria Steinem, who was supported by who worked with the CIA. But then I mentioned George Orwell, who was supported by the CIA. But then there are also a lot of figures in pop culture. A lot of musicians and artists, including Jackson Pollock, the splatter paint artist, including musicians like Dizzy Gillespie, a brilliant jazz musician, including musicians like the brilliant composer Bernstein, who did West Side Story, and including a lot of writers, and including progressive anti-racist writers who supported the civil rights movement. They were supported, a lot of them didn't know, They were supported by the CIA because the CIA was trying to create what it referred to as a non-communist left. That's the language they used. In reality, it was an anti-communist left. Right. They were trying to support publications that pushed an editorial line, an ideological perspective that said that, well, we're socialists, but we're not like the evil tankies. We don't actually support actually existing socialism in the Soviet Union, in Korea, in Vietnam, in Nicaragua, in Cuba. No, we don't support actually existing socialism, but we're still socialists. But we just
support
the
Democratic, but we also support the Democratic Party. Like, that's the other thing that's always funny to me about that attitude is like, oh, we won't support actually existing socialists or socialists in the third world because, you know, it's not pure enough. But then you align yourself with a capitalist party that like is very pro-war and hates socialism. It's actually, the contradictions are stunning. But you know, I want to move to a bit of it's a tangential topic here because it does include splits on the left, but it's not over the issue of imperialism. It's over something else that is quite controversial. We're about to step in it, but I think it's worth addressing because I think it's one of those moments that's going to be looked back at as something that split part of the anti-imperialist left to some degree. And that's the issue of COVID. And this is where, you know, it's like, it's a tough one, right? Because with COVID, this is a pandemic that involved needing to take a vaccine. And that's where things got really, there was two things I think that split people. I wanted to give my opinion and I want to hear like sort of your analysis of why this was the case. But there's two things that I think split the left on the issue of COVID. And one was the lockdown. I'm talking about the left in the global north. The lockdowns. There's a lot of people who were against the lockdowns because they thought this was like anti-working class. My position on this is that we didn't really have a lockdown in the US. and in fact, you know, there is a style of lockdown that benefited part of the ruling class, the sort of like tech industry ruling class, the Silicon Valley financial industry ruling class. And there was a split in the ruling class about lockdowns. But as far as like the left is concerned, the lockdowns didn't happen enough and they weren't supportive enough of workers, at least not in the US. But that seemed to split people because of what I think is a tendency among all Americans across the ideological spectrum, especially Americans, of libertarianism. And it's because it's so deeply ingrained in us from when we're like small, this idea of civil liberties, which are important to the point where you had a lot of people on the ostensible left in the US actually being against any state intervention over this pandemic. And then there was another issue, which is the issue of vaccines, where, you know, that's where the issue of Big Pharma comes in. It's totally understandable that people are suspicious of Big Pharma, the big pharmaceutical industry. Obviously, they lie. Everything's about making money. But it's very simplistic and black and white to go from that to vaccines are bad and we shouldn't take them and they're actually killing us. But I think that that's another... Oh, Ben, I lost you for a second, but you're back, I think. But I think that's another aspect of this that split the left. And I think both of these come back to a kind of libertarianism and a kind of like black and white thinking about that's actually just very much centered in the global north about the pharmaceutical industry that doesn't take into account how they actually screw the rest of the world not giving them vaccines. But I'm curious, you know, your analysis on this. What do you think it is about COVID that split the left? And I actually think it's incredibly damaging what's happened, but go ahead, I'll let you take it from here.
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. I think it shows that there's this libertarian streak in the US left. If you look at every country with a socialist government, they all took similar positions on COVID. And that doesn't necessarily mean like super eagerly imposing a lockdown. Obviously, everyone knows that lockdowns it's a bad thing because you don't want to shut people down. It's going to hurt the economy, but you also need to balance, you know, the fact that you want to save lives. And pretty much every country with a socialist government had similar public health policies of max vaccination when vaccines were available and basic public health measures. The difference is that in the US, there was a lot of understandable opposition to the lockdowns because the government provided no support. It provided one or two checks. And then, of course, Biden lied about providing another check of $2,000. Meanwhile, if you look at not even just countries with socialist governments, but even in Europe, these capitalist governments in Europe, they provided much more social support for their populations when they were put in lockdown. They provided them with money, with access to goods. I mean, China is, of course, the best example, where the government provided people with food and kits and all of these. And the reality is, in the US, you had this half-baked lockdown, which was not really a lockdown, and you had no support from the government, which meant that people had to pay their bills and they're going to get evicted from their houses. I mean, they had the temporary freezing of evictions, but that is no longer relevant, and there's a mass number of evictions going on right now. So the reality is that if you look at these people trying to take this position saying that this was all, like a big Jeff Bezos conspiracy or whatever. Yeah, I mean, Jeff Bezos made a lot of money, but what they want us to believe is that the Republican Party represents an anti-capitalist faction. What are they talking about? There was a huge faction of the U.S. capitalist class and the Republican Party itself that was against all of these measures, any kind of public health measure. And there are a lot of companies that actually wanted to end any public health measures because they wanted to get back to forcing people to go to work to make money. And yes, there were a few corporations like Amazon that maybe encouraged some of these policies because Amazon made a lot of money from the lockdown because people were at home, so they ordered things online. But those represent different splits within the capitalist class. The idea that all capitalists were supporting lockdowns or whatever is ridiculous. I would say that the majority of capitalists wanted to force people to get back to work, and they didn't care if their workers died because they'll just get a new worker. They'll just replace them, right? And the reality is that we need, instead of having this ridiculous kind of libertarian ideology become the normative position of the left should look at what actually existing socialist and progressive governments around the world have been doing in Cuba and Venezuela and China and Vietnam. They took very different positions, and obviously the results were significantly better. Even in countries like Korea, which has a very capitalist government, Korea in general, the East Asian countries, Japan, Korea, Singapore, they had much better policies and they saved countless lives. Meanwhile, the US, one of the most libertarian capitalist countries on earth, has had nearly 1 million deaths. And I think what this reflects is that this libertarian ideology, it's always been there in the US political culture, but I think it's gotten worse in recent decades. And why is that? Because libertarians are often some of the only people in the US that criticize war alongside the left, of course. If there's two factions in the US, political factions that at least criticize war and say that they oppose war, I would argue whether or not libertarians actually oppose war, but they say they oppose war. So there's the anti-war socialists, the left, and libertarians. So what that leads to is that there's often this kind of de facto alliance on certain issues, like opposing the Iraq war, opposing the Libya war, opposing the Syria war, the Yemen war. And what that leads to is sometimes there's this kind of friendship that happens between socialists and libertarians, and they start trying to merge their ideology together. But when it comes to public health, that's a complete anathema, because libertarians don't believe in public health. They believe in private profit. They believe that public health should be subordinated to the free market. And the reality is that seeing people on the left oppose public health measures is very concerning, because look, if we had socialized healthcare, would they say that this is government authoritarianism forcing us to do public health measures? No. One of the only times the US government has actually even pretended in any way to care about public health is during this pandemic. Obviously, they did a very bad job of it. But when a government, even if it's a bourgeois government, tries to implement some basic public health measures, we want public health measures because we eventually want universal socialized healthcare. But instead, we see some of these people who are taking this libertarian talking point that, it's always bad because, public health is bad because the US government is bad. That is not a sophisticated analysis of the situation.
No.
And the reality is that if you say you want universal healthcare, then that involves an element of government control. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if the government is actually acting on behalf of the interest of the public. Of course, in the US, the government only acts on behalf of the interest of capitalists because it's not in any way government.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's really well said. And then also it is amazing how there, you know, I don't even know what people are still upset about, because it's like, what state interventions are even taking place in the US anymore? Like, I don't even know if there are any. Like, you won, it's over. And now like the Ukraine, you know, it's Ukraine that's front and center, and it's kind of like COVID has ended, even though COVID is very much still ripping through various communities. It's like a lull right now, but it's not over. We're still in the middle of a pandemic, though, of course, at least there's like a vaccine now, if you can access it, to, you know, if you do get it, at least soften the hit. But that said, you know, Biden, I do want to come back.
Biden admin is actually taking money that was supposed to be for COVID public health measures and putting it toward military expenditure for Ukraine.
Yeah. There was supposed to be $14 billion or $15 billion for COVID stuff. And then overnight, like, they didn't approve that. And then suddenly $15 billion went to Ukraine to give weapons to Ukraine. But to just bring it back to the issue of Ukraine, you know, one thing that's been really amusing to watch is, not amusing, actually, I feel relieved that you can probably relate to me here. I feel relieved to have endured this war on Ukraine from the global south, because it seems like America or anywhere in Europe right now is an incredibly suffocating place to be politically, at least, where you just hear one narrative, one side. Anyone who questions it or, you know, says anything inconvenient about, you know, the role of the far right in Ukraine on the ground, and or get it, you know, them getting weapons, or the role of NATO and the US and provoking this war. People like us, basically, who'd say things like we do, are immediately ostracized and shunned. And, you know, part of what we're talking about is how sometimes a portion of the left in the global north is responsible for doing that shunning. But it's been nice to not be in the US for this, because I don't have to deal with that, at least in my day-to-day life. And I think it's interesting because across the global south, even among sections of the ruling elite in these countries that are very pro-US, there's been a lot of abstaining from taking a side in this conflict, which I think probably speaks to the role of Russia as a powerful actor in world affairs, and also the weakening of the US and a lot of these, you know, clients in the global south watching the US kind of abandoning their clients over and over, whether it's in Afghanistan or even now. You know, NATO might be stronger than ever in terms of being united and being better funded in finding a reason for its existence again. But I think this also shows NATO's weakness, because it hasn't been able to respond, because that would mean nuclear, you know, armed, that would mean a armed hot war between nuclear armed countries. So anyways, all that's to say, you're in the global south, you're in Nicaragua. What has it been like experiencing this from there? And what do you think it says about the sort of global order that there's such a difference of opinion in the majority of the world than what we're seeing coming out of the US and Europe?
I think it says a lot. You at Breakthrough, Rania, and Eugene Puryear have been doing excellent coverage of this. I love seeing the interviews that you've done with people from South Africa and other different movements in the global south, in Latin America and Africa and Asia. You know, it's the statement in particular from South Africa, I think, is very important. I know you interviewed someone from the ruling party, the ANC, and the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, also made very similar comments. The president of South Africa, a major country, said that NATO and the US, specifically NATO, bear responsibility for causing the war in Ukraine, which is pretty obvious to anyone who knows the kind of basic history of this conflict, going back to the US-sponsored coup in Ukraine in 2014. But we've seen again and again in the global south, leaders have made very similar comments, saying that while they might not openly endorse the war, for instance, the ANC in South Africa and Ramaphosa, the president, did not endorse the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and many movements in the global south have not endorsed the invasion, but they have said, they've made it very clear that it's the US and NATO that bear responsibility for starting this war, for provoking Russia at every single stage, for surrounding Russia and making Russia basically forcing it to reply in some way. And that doesn't mean that we defend the invasion, but the reality is that if you ignore that part of the equation, you can't call yourself an anti-war activist or anti-imperialist or whatever, because the reality is that we see this simplistic narrative among some parts of the left that say that, particularly in North America and Western Europe, they say that, well, if you're an anti-war activist, you have to oppose the war in Ukraine. But this is not a war that just started on February 24th, right? This is a war that started in 2014 when the U.S. overthrew Ukraine's democratically elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, and installed a right-wing regime that repressed the rights of Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East. And by the way, there was a lot of violence in that coup, including in Odessa in May of 2014. There were over 50 people who were burnt to death after neo-Nazis and extremists, they set fire to a union hall, a labor union building, and there were leftists who were burnt to death. That's never mentioned, by the way. And then in 2015, the U.S.-backed Ukrainian government, the right-wing government, they banned the Communist Party. They banned the use of all communist symbols, of any left-wing symbols. And of course, Zelensky just banned all the remaining socialist parties. So none of that's ever acknowledged. And yet alone the fact that from 2014 until when Russia invaded on February 24th, 14,000 Ukrainians died in 8 years of the civil war fueled by NATO and the US and Europe. And those 14,000 Ukrainians are never mentioned. Those were Ukrainians who died before Russia sent a single troop in. And many countries in the global South, they recognize this because they have been victims of these proxy wars, of these coups and operations organized by the US. And they have seen very clearly that Russia has also taken a foreign policy that has been supportive of them. And this, I think, is another reason why Russia is pretty popular in the global South. What's interesting is that Russia's popular not only with left-wing governments in the global South, even some right-wing governments in the global South, like in India, which is one of the most horrific right-wing regimes right now in the world. But India has its own national interest, regardless of who the president, the prime minister of India is. Right now it's Narendra Modi. But if the Indian National Congress, the kind of center-left party, if they were in power, they would be taking a very similar position because India has national interests and Russia is one of its important partners in terms of oil, gas, wheat, fertilizers, and trade. So a lot of countries in the global South, they recognize that Russia is in this situation that they can identify with. Now, I should be clear that many of these governments, again, did not openly endorse the invasion. So for instance, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Bolivia have all taken a position of criticizing the US and NATO. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, has actually created a campaign to abolish NATO and training people, educating people about the history of NATO's crimes. But at the same time, these countries, you know, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, they have not openly endorsed the invasion, but they have said that the US and NATO bear responsibility for starting the war. So I think that that's, and China has the same position. China has said that the US and NATO bear responsibility for starting the war in Ukraine, but has not openly endorsed the war. And that makes sense because these countries also very much value the principles of non-intervention and territorial integrity. And they understand that they can't support an invasion like this because then it would establish a precedent if the US uses Colombia to invade Venezuela or the US tries to invade China. They can't establish a precedent, but they also understand the historical context for what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that when we talk about what should be the anti-imperialist perspective, I got to say, Cuba's a place to look oftentimes. I mean, I think Cuba's one of the most solidly, and of course, like you'll often have a similar opinion in Nicaragua and Bolivia and these other, like in Venezuela and these other Latin American countries that have leftist governments. And even Iran, you know, when it comes to world affairs, has the same opinion. A lot of these countries aren't like gung-ho. They're not actually happy that there's a war. In fact, this war is going to impact them in a negative way as well. Just because of possible, you know, the rise in prices, whether it's oil prices, although that could benefit Venezuela, but rises in like food prices, these kinds of things that are a consequence of this war hurt developing countries more than countries in the global north. But that said, oftentimes, like it's like the opposite of what we were talking about in the beginning of this episode, where there's like that social chauvinism that the third world can't be, it doesn't have the answer to anything because it's too weak and backwards. Actually, you know, I really do like Cuba almost always has the right take.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important what you're saying about where Cuba's coming from. And, you know, Ben, I mean, I've taken a lot of your time. I know we've gone on for quite some time, but because we're talking about this kind of change in the global order, a lot of times we hear the use of the term multipolarism as moving from a unipolar to a multipolar world. I noticed there was an attack on your new outlet recently, Multipolarista, which everybody should check out. I'll include a link to it in the description, multipolarista.com. But there was this like right-wing attack on it, trying to accuse you of being like a Duganist or something and trying to attribute the term multipolarism to Duganism, which is actually like super absurd. But so this is like a two-prong question. Can you just explain to our audience what is meant by multipolarism? And then from there, what is the reason you named your outlet Multipolarista, which I imagine has more to do with the changing global order than with anything Alexander Dugan has ever said. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to address that.
Yeah, it is everything to do with the changing global order and nothing in any way to do with this fascist idiot named Dugan, who's this fringe idiot from Russia, who is this far right guy who, I mean, his influence in Russia is very minor, but it's greatly exaggerated by these people like in Washington think tanks. They like to pretend their narrative that they try to construct is that Vladimir Putin is a secret crypto fascist and that he's secretly advised by Dugan, who's this fringe academic who actually lost his job. He's not even a professor anymore. Like, he's so fringe that even in Russia, he's not even respected, but he's a literal fascist. I mean, he's an idiot. I hate this guy. I'm against everything that he says. He also, by the way, the irony is that Alexander Dugan has called for breaking up China, just like the Western imperialists who like to claim that we're all secret Duganists. No, Dugan has written openly that China should be broken up because China's too big. And he's against China.
Just because it's too big. That's the only reason.
Because he wants to bring back the kind of czarist Russian empire. He's against Russia's alliance with China. I mean, like, it's absurd. Actually, a lot of these Western imperialists have more in common with Dugan than we do. Like, Dugan's an idiot. The idea that Alexander Dugan created the concept of multipolarity is nonsense. In Latin America, in the global South in general, but especially in Latin America, progressive forces have been talking about the concept of multipolarity for decades. Hugo Chavez, the revolutionary former president of Venezuela who launched the Bolivarian Revolution, he was talking about multipolarity before he became president. On his on his campaign trail in 1998, he gave this famous speech in which he said that the world needs to be multipolar. He said, "We just came out of a bipolar world in the first Cold War. Now we're in a unipolar world." He said, "We want a multipolar world." What is multipolarity? It's a world in which there are multiple balances of power. It's not dominated by just one imperialist power, this unipolar hegemon, which is the United States now, right? Until recently, we've been living in a unipolar world ever since the end of the first Cold War, the US being the world leader representing capitalism and imperialism. It overthrew the Soviet Union, overthrew the Eastern Bloc, and then we had a series of regime change wars to overthrow any government that had any kind of mildly socialist or kind of state control over the economy. So Libya, they did it in Iraq, they tried to do it in Syria. And of course, what did the US do in Iraq after overthrowing? I mean, Saddam Hussein was horrible, but what did the US do in Iraq after overthrowing this country that had a lot of state control over the economy? They privatized everything. They brought in interns from the American Enterprise Institute to impose neoliberal shock therapy like Chile did under Pinochet. So that's the Washington consensus. That's the US program. And that's been the unipolar era of neoliberalism, right? So leftists in Latin America have been calling for a multipolar world for decades. Hugo Chavez from decades was calling for a multipolar world. Lula da Silva in Brazil was calling for a multipolar world. Venezuela, basically every time Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela gives a speech, he calls for a multipolar world. That's one of the main reasons that I decided, I mean, I was trying to think of an idea for, I mean, these are the topics that I write about as a journalist, right? And I was trying to think of an idea that could kind of bring all of my journalist my journalistic work together as a kind of common theme. And it's about this historic shift that we're seeing in the world with the decline of U.S. unipolarity and this fundamental crisis within imperialism, within the imperial core, and the rise of all of these, you know, contradictions. And you have countries like Turkey, which is this, you know, Erdogan is like this kind of neo-Ottomanist who wants to kind of bring back the Turkish Empire, but he's also a member of NATO. So he helps U.S. imperialism try to destroy Syria, but then he buys the S-400 Russian missile defense system. So, I mean, and then you have India, which is this horrible far-right government, but it's also part of the BRICS system still. But then Brazil? Also it's refusing to impose sanctions on Russia, but it's also part of the Quad, which is the attempt by the US to create an alliance against China. So India is really anti-China, but it's also pro-Russia. So, I mean, there's massive world historic shifts that we're seeing right now. And there's this simplistic idea in the US that it's all just authoritarianism versus democracy. And the US created this so-called democracy summit. And India was divided to this summit for democracy, even though India is a far-right authoritarian regime. And then Taiwan was invited to the summit for democracy, which is part of China. So anyway, the point is that, I mean, we are going through world historic shifts right now. And that's one of the reasons I think so many progressive movements in the global South keep talking about this idea of multipolarity is because they understand that multipolarity offers them a possibility to survive. Because under the bipolar system in the first Cold War, right, countries were forced to pick a side between the US and the Soviet-led socialist bloc. Many of them in the Global South, by the way, chose the Soviet-led socialist bloc. There was an attempt to create a non-aligned movement, right? The Bangdun Conference, and in your recent interview with a Brazilian academic, he had a great talk about why we need to bring back the Bandung Conference. As the world right now is becoming increasingly bipolar in this new Cold War, there are calls for this kind of new non-aligned movement. Although we should keep in mind that, by the way, China and Russia are both observers of the non-aligned movement. So
yeah,
even that is more complicated. But anyway, the point is that countries like Venezuela, Nicaragua, Vietnam, China, they recognize that a multipolar world will allow them more room to breathe, to help develop, so they can implement socialist policies and help raise the standard of living of workers and give them better healthcare and education and opportunities and fight poverty and unemployment. If you're under siege, under sanctions by the unipolar hegemon, by the US, which controls your finances through the IMF and the World Bank, through the dollar, which can suffocate your economy by kicking you out of the SWIFT system, I mean, you can't build socialism. This isn't to criticize.
Sovereignty, not even just socialism. You can't have like any sovereignty under that system at all. When your finances, when your ability to purchase and import is so tightly controlled by these international financial institutions, which are really just the United States, that gives them so much leverage over your ability to just control your own country, let alone to build a socialist politics. But sorry, continue.
It's like there's so many racist stereotypes about North Korea. And it's like, but imagine, this is, people keep saying now that Russia is the most sanctioned country in history. It's actually not true. North Korea continues to be and has always been the most sanctioned country in history. And they still have managed to hold on. Like, you know,
because of China, actually, and China is a huge reason why they're able to, but also because of their own state building project and their own developmental policies that we're not allowed to ever learn about, by the way, because everything North Korean is completely evil.
Yeah, but the point is that, like, I mean, we have to understand why North Korea is the way it is. It's because it's been under siege ever since the U.S. waged a genocidal war in Korea that killed 3 million Koreans, and technically the war never ended. And the U.S. has continued threatening the country and imposing sanctions. I mean, that is not a way for any. I mean, I'm like, the North Korean people have tried to survive, but like, it's very hard. No one wants to be under that kind of siege for their entire lives. That's what this kind of unipolar and bipolar system looks like. Multipolarity, the idea is that it would offer more opportunities and rooms to breathe for these movements in the global South. And we see this with the attempt to create new institutions. I mentioned the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and You know, if Lula da Silva comes back in Brazil, that could really bring life back into the BRICS system. We've also seen the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which brings together China and Russia and Iran, just became a new member, and also India and Pakistan, which they don't agree in anything. But even in Russia recently, India and Pakistan have been united. So, I mean, we're seeing this very important shift. And I think that, you know, I've had discussions with your colleague, Brian Becker, about this, and I agree that multipolarity is not the end goal. The end goal is socialism, right? But multipolarity is a step toward, is a necessary step toward socialism, because you can't have socialism. I mean, look at Cuba. Cuba is a glorious example. What they've tried to do and what they have accomplished is incredible. You've done amazing coverage about this, Rania, of their health system. They have 6 COVID vaccines. I mean, they sent doctors to over 130 countries around the world. It's incredible what they've accomplished under this criminal, suffocating siege. But imagine what they could accomplish if they weren't under a siege, right? And the reason they can't is because of imperialism and because of this system imposed on them. That's why Cuba has been one of the leading defenders calling for a multipolar world. And unfortunately, I mean, I think the world is actually looking much more bipolar than multipolar. Yeah. But there's this group that released this really brilliant manifesto, which I strongly agree with, which is called the International Manifesto Group. And there's people like Radhika Desai and Carlos Martinez and Danny Haifong, who are all part of that group. They're brilliant. They're all do great work on their own. And they have this interesting manifesto that's called Through Pluripolarity to Socialism. And pluripolarity is another way, basically it's the same as multipolarity, talking about how the splits going on right now in this international system, the decline of US unipolar hegemony, and the fundamental contradictions within the imperialist system that was created after World War II through the Bretton Woods Conference with the IMF and the World Bank, and all of this with the decline of the dollar as the de facto global reserve currency. We're in a very interesting moment. And to document that as a journalist, to report on it, to help people understand it, that's why I created this outlet, Multipolarista. And it's called that also because it's a bilingual outlet. I do a lot of stuff in Spanish as well. So, I mean, that's also one of the reasons, Rania, that we've been friends for a long time, but I really respect the work that you're doing, because it's very much, I think, in a similar vein, especially coming more from the West Asian perspective. And more, you know, I'm in Latin America, more and more we see that these forces in West Asia and Iran and Yemen and Lebanon, Al-Mayadeen, they're working together more and more with the progressive forces in Latin America, and understanding, you know, that there is this kind of historic shift happening. And we've seen in the non-aligned movement that Iran and Venezuela have been working together, and, you know, Iran helping Venezuela get around sanctions and vice versa. It's a very interesting historical moment. And I think that, you know, anyone, it's very easy to be depressed if you look at what's happening in the US and Western Europe, because these governments have become so authoritarian. These so-called bourgeois democracies have become so authoritarian. The left has become so silenced and censored and repressed. It's easy to be very, you know, depressed. It's easy to be very pessimistic. But while I don't think in any way we shouldn't in any way abandon the struggle in the global north for socialist transformation and progressive transformation, we need to be part of the struggles. I think at the same time, it's much easier to have confidence and be optimistic if you look at what's happening around the world. And I'm not calling for people to abandon the global north and say that they should not try to organize their workplaces. But what I'm saying is something different. I'm saying that if you have this Eurocentric or Americentric worldview, it's easy to be depressed. But if you actually see what's happening around the world with all these breakthroughs happening, you know, breakthrough news, there's all these breakthroughs happening. I actually think that's a way not only to help understand, you know, what's going on internationally politically, but it's also a way to help strengthen the left and the global north by invigorating it and providing life to this movement by understanding that, yes, the struggle is difficult, but this is an international struggle. We have comrades around the world. Some of them are succeeding. And if they can succeed, we can succeed too.
No, that's so well said. And, you know, it does make me think a lot when I look at the people. It's so interesting. The like, it's like a planet's apart, the way people in the global north are talking, particularly Europe and the US, are talking about the war in Ukraine versus elsewhere, especially because I think that war is such a known thing. Nobody likes war. Nobody's like, you talked about the position of Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, Nicaragua. They're not happy about this war. No one's happy about this war because they don't like war. I mean, the only people who are really happy about a war are like weapons companies and imperialists. No one's happy about this war, but they do recognize that it does mean a shift that's going to give them, they hope, the breathing space they need to like be a little less under the boot of American empire. And so there's like a different view in the global South that I think that you just kind of like laid out quite well. But on that note, Ben, I want to thank you so much for giving me so much of your time. I feel like there's a million other things to talk about, but we'll have to like do it on a different episode so that people can digest everything we talked about here. But thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for your incredible work. Everybody needs to go. If you haven't already, check out Multipolarista. Where else can people follow along, follow your work?
Yeah, well, they can find me on Twitter at Benjamin Norton, and I spend too much time tweeting, but you know, a lot of my work is built into Multipolarista these days. So it, you know, keep up the amazing work that you do, Rania. Breakthrough has become probably my favorite media outlet. You all do consistently.
Thank you.
Amazing work. And you're so prolific. I mean, you always have so many great interviews. And then finally, thank you for letting me rant about this stuff. No, I know.
Anytime.
There's a lot of details to get into, but I'm glad I had the space, the platform to do that.
Anytime. And we'll definitely have you back on soon. Thank you so much.